Greetings, droogies. Ready are you to govereat about another grozzy prestupnik? Well, my brothers, hold on to your yarbles, for today we have for you a real horror show malchick. Vidi him nosh his way through the pages of books to the cine, to the real wide world. Don't go all poogly at the vidi of some crovy. We promise to call the Millicents if things get too bazoomy. Oh, what's that? You don't speak Natsat? Well, that might be a problem, because today we're talking about Alex from A Clockwork Orange. Get ready to never think of Singing in the Rain the same way again. Welcome to Villains, a Parcast original. I'm Alastair Murden. On this show, we look at the world's most infamous villains, both real and imagined. We aim to understand how villainy translates from history into our greatest fictional stories. You can find episodes of Villains and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Villains for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Villains in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. This is episode 7 of 10 on postmodern psychopaths. Last week, we discussed Ed Gein, the corpse-obsessed small-town killer. His gender-questioning antics inspired decades of horror films, from Psycho to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This week, we're going into the retro future to meet the most sinister teenager in all of fiction, Alex DeLarge, from Anthony Burgess's novel A Clockwork Orange and the Stanley Kubrick film of the same name. He's a villain through and through, and yet his punishment is perhaps too severe. Alex leads us to wonder, is a world where we could brainwash a killer into being good one we want to live in? Or is the removal of choice the ultimate evil? A Clockwork Orange may just provide the answer. The book was written in the course of just 3 weeks by English author Anthony Burgess. Published in 1962, it was met with mixed reviews and poor sales. It is a challenging novel. Burgess invented a futuristic slang called Nadsat, in which the entire story is narrated. As you heard in our intro, it can be quite confusing if you don't have a glossary handy. Throughout this episode, we'll try to summarize quotes that are hard to understand. But beyond the difficult language, the subject matter of A Clockwork Orange is also challenging. The story follows a thieving, raping, murdering psychopath. Needless to say, he's hard to root for. Alex is 15 years old when we meet him. He runs around at night with his pals Georgie, Pete, and Dim. They enjoy what Alex refers to as a bit of the ultraviolence. Alex is antagonistic and selfish in every aspect of his life. He dominates his friends as the gang leader. At home, he threatens his parents and essentially treats them as servants. When it comes to women, he doesn't know how to lead a healthy romantic relationship. He forces himself on all of them. Perhaps his only saving grace is his love of classical music, specifically Beethoven. It offers him a rare glimpse of the beauty that is otherwise missing from his life. But this villain, as reprehensible as he is, was destined to be glamorized in one of the most iconic films in American history. Acclaimed filmmaker Stanley Kubrick's 1971 adaptation of the novel rocketed Alex into the pop culture consciousness. Portrayed by then-newcomer actor Malcolm McDowell, Alex was physically attractive and endearing for his rebelliousness. His bowler hat and strange single fake eyelash over his right eye, along with his eyeball cufflinks, made him instantly iconic. In a 2006 interview, McDowell said of the character, "What a great part." He specifically called out the improvisational nature of working with Kubrick, which allowed Alex to develop naturally. There are thus two different versions of the character, similar in some ways, different in others. We'll contrast the two and what they mean to our culture. When we first meet Alex in both the book and the film, he is in a milk bar, a futuristic hangout where patrons drink drug-spiked lactose. This perhaps speaks to how they numb themselves to their actions. Their life is all about the pursuit of pleasure, and anything that gets in the way of that is to be removed. The first part of the novel and film consists primarily of Alex and his droogs committing various horrific crimes. Burgess writes of how Alex sees these crimes as stimulating entertainment. When they beat an old man or the members of a rival gang, Alex revels in the blood. He calls it beautiful and like an old friend. His favorite activity by far is rape. When he and the droogs incapacitate a female shopkeeper early one evening, Alex thinks, "I wondered, should I or not?" But that was for later on in the evening. Rape is something he savors, something that has to cap off a night of debauchery, something that can't be done with just anyone. On the night in question, the woman he chooses is the wife of a writer. The writer is ironically working on a novel called A Clockwork Orange. Burgess thus inserts himself into the narrative somewhat, suggesting the irony that the man Alex is about to victimize is the man most likely to defend him. In the book, this scene plays out almost like a Viking raid, with the boys destroying the entire house. Georgie and Pete take food from the kitchen, making such a mess that Alex reprimands them. Meanwhile, Alex rips the writer's book manuscript to shreds. Here, Burgess is contrasting the act of creation with the act of destruction. Alex lacks the ability and drive to create, so he resents those who do. But at the same time, Burgess shows how the violence of Alex and the droogs feels so much more vital, so much more full of life than the humdrum existence of the writer and his wife. It is the contradiction at the heart of Alex's character. He is the only one in his world who chooses to live his own way. And so we perversely admire him, and yet he chooses evil, and so we just as quickly despise him. This is never more clear than when he and each of the droogs take a turn forcing themselves on the writer's wife. This is the pinnacle of Alex's sexual crimes in the film. However, in the novel, an equally heinous act comes a few days later. He lures two 10-year-old girls into his apartment and rapes them as well. At this point, we are questioning why we want to follow this character's story any further. It's hard to fathom why Burgess would want his novel's hero to be such a detestable villain. We also wonder why Alex is this way. We get very little of his history, and so we are unsure of what exactly motivates this behavior. There are some clues, however. In an article for The New Yorker, Burgess writes that he named Alex after Alexander the Great. He says, "Alex is a comic reduction of Alexander the Great, slashing his way through the world and conquering it. But he has changed into the conquered. Impotent. Wordless." Taking that one step further, he is an Alexander the Great with nothing to conquer. In the novel, he says, "I couldn't help a bit of disappointment at things as they were those days. nothing to fight against, really. This is echoed in the film, when Alex imagines himself as a Roman soldier fighting in a war and also partaking in the crucifixion. He has no positive philosophy guiding him, nothing to live for, as Christ did. And so he can only imagine himself tearing Christ down. We can derive some of his motivation from this lack of purpose. If Alex had literally anything else to focus his considerable charm and intellect onto, then perhaps he would. But he lives in a dystopia, designed as an amalgamation of New York, London, and Volgograd, a place where, according to the book, everyone is legally required to work unless they are with child or infirm. A place that Kubrick populates with brutalist architecture that speaks to this worship of efficiency. It's a world that also seems fairly obsessed with gratification. In the Kubrick film, nearly every space outside of the prison is decorated with imagery of nude women. And it is a world completely uninterested in education, or, as Alex refers to it, gloopy, useless learning. This echoes Burgess's dismay over the lack of free public education in Britain in the post-war years. In a 1972 interview, he said, "We did not train our young to take an active part in the modern, highly technological world." Of course Alex is the way he is. He has a lack of foundation, a lack of stimulating education, and he has nothing to look forward to but endless work. He was Burgess's condemnation of then modern English society, which was especially preoccupied with the rebellious youth beginning in the 1950s. In an article for History Extra, Dr. Abigail Wills wrote that, "In the 1950s, increasing youth crime in Britain was largely attributed to a decline in family cohesion following the war, and to increasing consumer affluence. The new youth cultures of the post-war era provided a focus for such beliefs. Particularly notable in the 1950s were the Teddy Boys with their flamboyant dress, fondness for US cultural imports such as rock and roll, and rowdy public behavior. They were seen as epitomizing the new culture of greed and amorality." Alex satirizes that attitude. On the one hand, Burgess is mocking these fears by replacing rowdy rock and roll teddy boys with rapey, milk-drinking droogs. On the other hand, he is showing how these youths actually are a natural outgrowth of the society they live in. Kubrick's version of the character leans into the satire. All in all, it is a far more humorous, sympathetic portrayal. Every filmmaking choice in A Clockwork Orange serves to make the viewer identify with Alex. We've already discussed how the very casting of Malcolm McDowell lends Alex a certain boyish charm. But there are some changes from the book that help to make him more sympathetic as well. Most obviously, the preteen girls he rapes become girls his own age that he has consensual sex with. Further, an elderly woman that Alex accidentally murders in the book becomes a condescending, airheaded yoga teacher in the movie. In an interview with French film critic Michel Simon, Kubrick calls her unsympathetic and unwisely aggressive. He wants you to dislike Alex's victims so that their rape or murder doesn't turn you against him. For Kubrick, Alex seems to have been less of a wannabe Alexander and more of an aspiring rebel without a cause. In that same interview, he said, "Perhaps in our unconscious, we are all potential Alexes. I think you find much the same psychological phenomena at work in Shakespeare's Richard III. You should feel nothing but dislike towards Richard, and yet he gradually works himself into your unconscious, and recognition occurs in the recesses of the mind. At the same time, I don't believe anyone leaves the theatre thinking Richard III or Alex are the sort of people one admires and would wish to be like." So if Burgess was saying, if you don't like Alex, it's because he's your fault, then Kubrick was saying, if you don't like Alex, it's because you hate the part of yourself that wants to be him. Both interpretations are based on the issues occupying the minds of their creators. For Burgess, it was about education and moral choice. For Kubrick, it was about recognizing the capacity for evil in all of us. But it's the second part of the story where we see these themes play out more explicitly. And it's that part of the story that was then directly echoed in real life. Next, we'll discuss the themes behind Alex's incarceration and attempted brainwashing, as well as the real-world controversy that threatened to get the movie pulled from theaters. Now, back to the story. We've discussed how Alex from the seminal film and novel A Clockwork Orange represents author Anthony Burgess's criticism of post-war society in England. We've also seen how for filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, he represented the villain inside of us all that society would like to oppress. But it's in the second part of the novel that we encounter the main theme driving Alex's appeal, which is that choice is what makes us human, and taking that away is the ultimate evil. After the accidental murder of the elderly lady, or in the film, the yoga teacher, Alex is sent to prison for 14 years. After 2 years, he hears of the Ludovico technique, a rumored treatment that cures you of your evil impulses so you can be released from jail. But the prison chaplain that Alex works with warns him of its dangers. He says, "Does God want goodness or the choice of goodness? Is a man who chooses the bad perhaps in some way better than a man who has the good imposed upon him?" The chaplain thus becomes a mouthpiece for the author, voicing the exact theme of the book. Burgess himself later wrote that life is sustained by the grinding opposition of moral entities. This is why the story is titled A Clockwork Orange. Burgess wrote, "If a man can only perform good or only perform evil, then he is a clockwork orange, meaning that he has the appearance of an organism lovely with color and juice, but is in fact only a clockwork toy to be wound up by God or the devil or the almighty state." Meanwhile, in the film, Kubrick communicates this message as well, though he does so by keeping the focus firmly on Alex. He continues to lean into the satire by contrasting the rebellious Alex with the pompous members of the prison system. In particular, Chief Guard Barnes, played by Michael Bates, shouts things like, "Shut your filthy hole, you scum," and "Let's have a little reverence, you bastards." These lines are performed with such volume and speed that we can't help but laugh at the ridiculousness. As Alex begins to undergo the Ludovico treatment, he is surrounded by cold, unfeeling scientists. Between these and the guards, of course we like Alex. He is the only one in the movie with any life to him. This was both Kubrick and Malcolm McDowell's intention in portraying the character. The goal was to show the lack of humanity in people who might try and control an individual, and to bring out the humanity in someone who lived freely, even if they chose to live immorally. Everyone around Alex had to be ridiculous. If the movie felt more like a comedy, then the rape and murder might seem less real, less disturbing. McDowell said, "I made, as far as I was concerned, this incredible black comedy." All of this is to say that it's hard not to feel some measure of sympathy for Alex in the second part of the story. He is strapped to a chair, and his eyelids are horrifically clamped open. he is made to watch hour after hour of disturbing imagery while under the influence of various drugs. It's essentially a form of aversion therapy, one that makes him sick to his stomach if he even thinks about committing a violent act. His choice has been taken away. On top of that, one of the films has Beethoven's Ninth Symphony as its soundtrack, one of Alex's favorite compositions. Beethoven, previously a source of great inspiration for Alex, the one beautiful thing in his life, now makes him sick. This was another key theme that Burgess wanted to bring out with Alex. The idea that there is violence in creation, violence in beauty. The opposing forces of good and evil are present in the winds, horns, and strings of the symphony. One scientist, a Dr. Brodsky, tells Alex, "The world is one. Life is one. The sweetest and most heavenly of activities partake in some measure of violence. The act of love, for instance. Music, for instance. You must take your chance, boy. The choice has been all yours." It hasn't really been a choice at all, however, as Alex had no idea that this is what the treatment would entail. Once the treatment is complete, Alex is indeed let back out into society. But we see how someone who cannot choose is hardly a person at all. He bounces around between his parents and his former gangmates and is mistreated by all. With his physical aversion to violence, he can do nothing to defend himself against their abuses. Finally, ironically, he winds up in the home of the writer whose wife he raped. Initially, the writer doesn't recognize him. It is revealed that his wife died, though it is ambiguous as to whether this was a result of Alex's actions or if the writer is merely placing the blame at Alex's feet. Burgess and Kubrick both portray the writer as fairly well unhinged at this point. In the book, Alex haphazardly makes reference to his old friend, Dim, a name the writer remembers from the night of the attack. He obsesses over this until he realizes who Alex is. In the film, Kubrick directs actor Patrick McGee to go completely hysterical at the revelation of who Alex is. He bulges out his eyes, sticks out his tongue. Once again, it's more funny than disturbing. In both versions of the story, the writer exploits a flaw in the Ludovico treatment and uses Beethoven's music to drive Alex insane. The Ludovico treatment made it so that whenever Alex thinks of or attempts violence, he becomes incredibly sick. It's as if his insides want to explode out of him. Beethoven's Ninth, in particular, makes Alex just as sick as if he attempted to rape again. By locking him in a room and forcing him to listen to the symphony, the writer makes Alex feel not only sick, but immensely depressed over this source of beauty that is now lost to him. He attempts suicide by jumping out a window. But Alex's tale doesn't end there. He survives and is resuscitated in a hospital. Once there, the minister of the entire country arrives and essentially bribes Alex to not reveal how the state almost killed him with its experiment. The state is firmly cemented as the real villain of the story, and Alex, just a not-so-innocent bystander. Kubrick explicitly communicated this point of view in an interview, saying, "Certainly, one of the most challenging and difficult social problems we face today is how can the state maintain the necessary degree of control over society without becoming repressive?" The state sees the specter looming ahead of terrorism and anarchy, and this increases the risk of its overreaction and a reduction in our freedom. As with everything else in life, it is a matter of groping for the right balance and a certain amount of luck. Unfortunately, English audiences didn't see the movie this way. Perhaps the most memorable change from the book to the movie is that during the rape of the writer's wife, Alex sings and dances to Singin' in the Rain. Malcolm McDowell has stated in multiple interviews that this was an improvisation on his part. Kubrick felt it elevated the scene and made it more cinematic. But then, after the release of the film in England in 1971, a 17-year-old girl in Lancashire was raped by a group of boys singing the song. In another part of the country, a youth beat a homeless man to death after being told of a similar scene from the movie. And in yet another part of the country, a group of boys supposedly dressed as the Droogs beat a Jehovah's Witness. One headline read, "Clockwork Orange Terror Wave." A general outrage ensued. Rather than viewing the film as a satire or black comedy, the public saw it as deeply disturbing and encouraging of violence. According to an article from The Guardian, one judge called the aforementioned crimes a horrible trend which has been inspired by this wretched film. Kubrick's wife, Christiane, said he was suddenly at the bottom of every crime ever committed. Instead of taking in the themes of the duality of violence and creation, of evil actions being a necessary counterpart to good actions, the public acted like the members of state in the film. They called for the removal of the film from theaters, in the same way that the state called for the removal of Alex's ability to choose. Christiane said that after multiple threats against his family, Kubrick called Warner Brothers and asked them to pull the film from the English market. However, this happened in 1973, over a year after the film's release. Many had already seen it, and Alex DeLarge was now a part of the collective culture. It would take England many years to learn the lessons he imparted. But Kubrick always defended his film and his portrayal of Alex, saying, "Films and TV are also convenient whipping boys for politicians because they allow them to look away from the social and economic causes of crime, about which they are either unwilling or unable to do anything." Scenes such as the Singin' in the Rain rape were not meant to make us admire Alex per se, but to think about his complex nature. Of Alex's love of music, Kubrick has said, "I think this suggests the failure of culture to have any morally refining effect on society. Hitler loved good music, and many top Nazis were cultured and sophisticated men, but it didn't do them or anyone else much good." Alex's complex nature and the themes it represents were something English society would take a long time to embrace. With the exception of bootleg copies, the film was completely unavailable in England until after Stanley Kubrick's death in 1999, when it was re-released by Warner Brothers. Now, nearly 20 more years have passed. What does Alex say to us today in the United States? Do we have something new to learn from him, just as the English did in 1971? A recently released missing chapter from the novel may hold the answer to that question. Next, we discuss how the secret ending to the novel changes its themes, and how the themes of both the book and film take on new significance in the age of the Me Too movement. Now, back to the story. We've discussed how Anthony Burgess's novel A Clockwork Orange and the subsequent film by Stanley Kubrick explore themes of moral choice. However, Kubrick's version ends differently than the book. We're shown Alex's fantasy as he makes love to a woman in the snow, surrounded by clapping onlookers. The film thus ends somewhat ambiguously. Was Alex cured? Has he reverted to his old self? Is he some new breed of state-sponsored criminal? Burgess's novel ends much less ambiguously, with a final chapter that was omitted from the American version of the novel. In that chapter, Alex returns home and leads a new gang. But he soon grows tired of doing the same thing night after night, and then he runs into his old gangmate, Pete. Alex is astonished to see that Pete, only a few years older, has a wife and a job. He is having a quick drink at a cafe before going on to a dinner party. A lifestyle that would have revolted Alex just a few years earlier now appeals to him. As he walks down the street, thinking to himself, he begins to imagine having a wife. He imagines having a son. He narrates, "I knew what was happening. Oh, my brothers. I was like growing up." Alex warmly imagines a future where his son grows and does all the same things he did. He says, "I knew he would not understand or would not want to understand at all and would do all the veshes I had done. Yes, perhaps even killing some poor starry forella. And I would not be able to really stop him. And so it would itty on to like the end of the world. Round and round and round." This ending was important to Burgess. He once wrote, "The final chapter gives the novel the quality of genuine fiction, an art founded on the principle that human beings change." He believed this is what made his work a novel and the film a mere fable. The idea that a person could change and make moral progress. For Burgess, this is what Alex represented as a villain. Ultimately, the author saw his creation as more of an anti-hero. Yes, he committed significant crimes, but the greater crime was the state's attempt to take away his ability to choose. As we've discussed, Burgess finds multiple points throughout the novel to highlight how important he believes choice is. He felt that by cutting the final chapter, the film and the American version of the book pushed the notion that human nature was inherently evil and had no capacity for change. That was villainous. That was the real sin. When it came to the film, however, Burgess may have had a bit of a blind spot. Kubrick actually disliked the final chapter, saying, "It is, as far as I am concerned, unconvincing and inconsistent with the style and intent of the book." And all in all, Kubrick's version of the story communicates a very similar theme despite discarding the ending. As we've discussed, every choice in the movie works to highlight Alex as the likable rogue and his victims as stuck-up non-entities. They aren't as human as him because they do not exercise their right to choose. They live within the small boxes society has defined for them. They are the Clockwork Orange. The rapturous lovemaking at the end highlights the powerful contrast between Alex and the society around him, which is portrayed by a crowd of Victorian-era socialites. This is a contrast that Kubrick found glorious. He said, quoting Milton's Paradise Lost, "Villains are always more interesting. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." In his exploration of this villain, Kubrick may have been exploring some aspects of himself. Any study of Kubrick's career will reveal that there was plenty of darkness to him that might make us see him as a villain. He made actress Shelley Duvall do 127 takes for one shot in The Shining, and tried to keep actor Matthew Modine from leaving the set of Full Metal Jacket to see the birth of his son. And in A Clockwork Orange, he made Malcolm McDowell use eye clamps that caused him to go temporarily blind. And these are just a few examples from a long career of psychologically and physically scarring people in the name of his art. Kubrick was a genius, but a mad one. Today's Hollywood, though still filled with a number of problematic individuals, is at least potentially slightly more self-aware due to the Me Too movement. Beginning in October 2017, many actresses began to speak out against powerful men in Hollywood who had abused them. Change has begun, but there is a long way to go. By understanding that power in Hollywood can be used abusively, today it is possible to see Kubrick as a type of villain, while still trying to learn from the artistry of his films. Similarly, while Burgess and Kubrick may have seen Alex as an anti-hero or even an outright hero, today he comes across firmly as a villain. And we can learn new things from that understanding. Burgess's point about the importance of moral choice is duly noted, but his 1960s good old boy point of view led him to value Alex's choice over that of his victims. The final chapter is fairly misogynistic in this sense. It doesn't help that Burgess writes Alex as thinking that his old friend Pete's wife was not the sort you would like to throw down and give the old in-out, in-out to, but with a horror show plot and litzo and a smiling rot and very, very fair veloce and all that cow. Alex is essentially saying that Pete's wife was classy, implying that non-classy women deserve to be raped. This is framed as Alex growing up. And it's an attempt to tack a moral lesson onto the ending of a story that was really more of a dark satire of exactly those kinds of moral lessons. As author Daniel Podgorski writes, "I don't find it particularly satisfying or illuminating for the ending to have the juvenile rapist Alex DeLarge living happily ever after with a nice little family. And I want this least of all when the only reason to include it is so that its author can force the moral of his story down my throat." Today's viewers or readers of A Clockwork Orange ironically do see exactly what Burgess wanted them to, but not by being sympathetic to Alex. Rather, it's by seeing the horror of his actions in taking the choice away from his victims. He reminds us of the very real men who have been accused of similar acts in the press. In October 2018, in a piece by the New York Times, it was reported that over 200 men were ousted or stepped down from prominent positions as a direct result of the Me Too movement. These men are real-life villains who, like the men in Clockwork Orange and the dystopian government of their story, chose to take away another human being's agency and right to bodily autonomy. This is why Alex, for all his silly vocabulary, ridiculous clothing, and lack of any real power or accomplishment, is a terrifying villain to a modern audience. We know that men like this walk among us. Men who seem stylish and exciting on the surface, but beneath that exterior embody the ultimate selfishness, the willingness to force themselves on another human for their own gratification. We look at Alex and we wonder what is an appropriate punishment for someone like him. Many scientists throughout the years have pursued real-life aversion therapy techniques in the hopes of curing such criminals. As we'll see next week, the results are rarely successful. These questions regarding what atonement and reparation might look like are raised against a story backdrop that also communicates fears of an increasingly oppressive state, growing crime rates, and what is perceived as less civilized younger generations. For all these reasons, both book and film remain important and provocative works of fiction over the decades, even if the way we perceive them changes. And Alex remains a prescient villain in our modern consciousness. His haunting gaze from behind his fake eyelash dares us to try and make sense of him. Over 50 years later, and we're still trying. Thanks for listening to Villains. Next week, we'll dive deeper into the cultural backdrop against which A Clockwork Orange was written, as we explore real-life examples of ultraviolence and aversion therapy. You can find all episodes of Villains and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Villains, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Villains on Spotify, just open the app and type Villains in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Villains was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler. Sound designed by Trent Williamson, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Freddie Beckley, and Paul Marler. This episode of Villains was written by Greg Castro. I'm Alastair Murden.